honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, preparing you for the 75th anniversary of the Normandy invasion by listening to firsthand accounts from that fateful moment in world history. The vast majority of the Americans who stormed Fortress Europe on June 6, 1944, are no longer with us. Some of those few who remain will be in France for the 75th anniversary, and one of them will be conducting an orchestra made up of 10 different musical groups from around the U.S. Colonel Arnold Gabriel has done just about everything you can do in the musical world. He was there at Normandy for the 70th anniversary, conducting a similar collection of musicians. But if you can get this almost 94-year-old to slow down enough in his active schedule to talk about it, as he did a few years ago with us in front of a live audience of students at Clovis North High School in California, he'll tell you how he experienced D-Day with the 29th Infantry Division as a 19-year-old.
Well, it was fear, confusion, fright, a little bit of everything. Nobody landed where they were supposed to. Not the 82nd Airborne, who jumped before we hit the beach. We hit the beach way left of where we were supposed to, and I ended up with the 1st Division, which was on our left flank. I was then with the 116th Easy Company, and I said, I've got to get back to the 29th Division. And so, total confusion. I didn't have my machine gun because I left that in the water. The water was up to my waist, and most of us either that deep or some have never made it, drowned before they got to the beach. But anyway, so I made my way back to the 29th and ended up with I Company, the 175th. They said, we need a machine gunner. You're going to be with us now. I said, well, you better call E Company so they know I'm not dead. So that's what they did. So that whole day was nothing but confusion.
And I want to talk about something you said there. You're going into the water, and you had to leave your machine gun behind. Mm-hmm. Now, this is supposed to be not just your protection, but protection for a whole bunch of your fellow soldiers. Right. So now you don't have that. You're coming ashore, and I imagine that there's enemy gunfire and artillery all around you, right?
Exactly. But, you know, there were so many weapons that were dropped by people who did get ashore who were killed. If you needed a weapon, there it was on the beach because the person who was carrying it was probably killed. And there's another quick fact. In a division, there are 15,000 men, 9,000 of which were combatants, frontline troops. And my son, who's writing my biography, did his homework and discovered that the 29th Infantry Division suffered more casualties in World War II in that 11 months from June 44 till May 45 when the war was over. We had 20,000 casualties. Amazing.
That's a heavy number.
Yeah.
And for you, 19 years old, halfway around the world from home, getting shot at without what you were supposed to have to protect you, what in the world was going through your mind?
Well, like I said, fright, confusion, just you weren't thinking very straight, just to survive.
Now, this may sound like a dumb question, but I'm sure a lot of these young people are wondering themselves about it. Were you scared? Did you think that was it? Did you think you were going to see another day beyond June 6th?
No. I never thought I'd live to be 90, but there was a time when I didn't think I was going to live 10 more minutes. That's what war was like.
I believe it. And we look at now, and I'm just looking at your schedule of all the places around the country that you're going to be sharing your talents musically and thinking of all the lives that you've touched, much less your children and grandchildren. You even have great-grandchildren yet?
I do. I have 13 grandchildren and one great-grandchild.
And none of them would be here if you had been one of those guys from your division who didn't survive past that day.
Yeah.
And just to talk about some of your decorations in the war, and we're going to get to music, and it all ties together, and it's incredible the path that your life has taken. But you're a recipient two times over of the Bronze Star, which isn't easy to get. You earned the Combat Infantry Badge. If you guys ever see a veteran wearing a little blue rectangular badge with a rifle in the middle of it, that's a Combat Infantry Badge. You only earn that by being in combat, as Colonel Gabriel was. I'm sure you're not dying to talk about why you got this or why you got that, but from D-Day, that's just the beginning. I'm sure you had a whole lot of experience from that point on. What are some of the ones that stand out that remind you of how fortunate or blessed you are to still be around?
Well, I joined the 29th Infantry Division in Europe. As I said, they were there in 42. So I was a replacement. trained in the United States as a BAR, Browning Automatic Rifle. When I got to the 29th, they said, no, you're going to be a machine gunner. Oh, really? So they trained me on a machine gun. And what they told me, this was absolutely true fact, that the life expectancy of a 30 caliber light machine gun in combat is 3 days. That's what I had to look forward to. And so when we went ashore on D-Day, like I said, we were supposed to take Saint-Lobe, the first big major city in France, in 7 days, and it was the middle of July, so it was about 45 days before we took Saint-Lobe. And then we went to the port of Brest, and the reason we went there, those of you who are history buffs, know that that's where the submarine bases were that scourged our fleets coming from the United States, troop ships and supply ships. And so by taking Brest, we would have silenced all of those submarines. But what we didn't realize is that they had a 240-millimeter cannon, huge. I mean, it was like a freight train when you heard one of those shells coming overhead. And they were trained, of course, into the ocean. But we didn't know that they turned 180 degrees on us. So that's what we faced in Brest.
If you read Colonel Gabriel's book, completed in 2016 with his son Michael, it's called The Force of Destiny, and I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, you'll learn how close we came to missing out on this legendary conductor's global music career, and how he has honored those who never made it home from the war, including some of his closest friends.
I met two men who were replacements for my machine gun squad, Harry Ashoff and Johnny Aerosmith. And they were with me for 3 months. Now, that's unusual. Like I said, the expectancy was 3 days. So we became very close. I knew all about their family. And on January 9th, 1945, the three of us were in a machine gun or in a foxhole, and we were hit by a German mortar, and both of them were killed. So they're buried in Margraten Cemetery in Netherlands. And they had their families were looking for somebody that knew their father in combat. So they wrote to the Army Records Section, they wrote to the Veterans Administration, they wrote to everybody they could think of. And then a few years ago, as you know, we built the World War II Memorial. And so I was a charter member. So they wrote to the World War II Memorial and said, is Harry Ashoff and Johnny Aerosmith, you know what, where they might be? Because they didn't even know where they were buried. And they said, oh yes, they're members. And I said, how can that be? They were killed back in 45. Well, it was a Staff Sergeant Arnold Gabriel who signed them up as charter members, and that's how they found me. And so we had become very, very close. Harry Ashoff had a 2-year-old son, and that 2-year-old son came to Washington 4 years ago, and I gave them the tour, took him to World War II Memorial, and he's going to get his car to drive back to New Jersey. And he said, before I leave, he said, I want to ask you something, but before that, I want a hug. So he gave me a hug, and he said, will you be my dad? Mm.
That gets you.
Yeah.
I've talked to a lot of veterans who came home and met their first child for the first time at 3 or 4 years old because they'd been born while they were shipping off or their wife was pregnant while they were shipping off. I've also met children who've had a lifelong quest, like your friend's son, to learn about their parents. So what you provided for him, holy moly, that's powerful. But there's another question that I have after hearing that story, and I bet some of you students are thinking the same thing. You said the three of you were all in the same foxhole, right?
Mm-hmm.
The mortar killed the two of them, but not you.
I was very lucky. I got a concussion and some bruises. I was authorized to get the Purple Heart, and I said, I can't get the Purple Heart. My two buddies were killed. I'm not going to get it for a few bruises, so I didn't get the Purple Heart.
I know this isn't easy to talk about again, but how do you deal with that? Again, you're still a young man, barely older than these kids at Clovis North High School here.
19 years old.
To have your two best friends who've been with you for months killed.
3 months, right. Yeah.
Not to mention what happened to you in the process. How do you process that and move on and continue to stay alive and fight the enemy?
Well, I didn't go right back to the front line. I stayed back with the kitchen unit, which was back in the rear area for 3-4 days until I regained my composure. My lieutenant gave me some advice, which is valuable for everybody in this room. I couldn't deal with reality. I couldn't deal about going back to the front line again. And Lieutenant Butler came to me and he said, I was still a private then. He said, Private Gabriel, he said, now you've got to get on your feet. You've got to get back to the front line and put that all behind you. I said, yeah, but Lieutenant, do you remember Saint-Lobe? Do you remember D-Day? He said, hold it right there. It's okay to look back. Just don't stare. Great advice for everybody. Because we all have things in our lives that were traumatic. But we have to put those things behind us and move on. And that's what I did. After the war was over, I was very confused. I was still only 20 years old when I was separated. And I had the war behind me at 20 years old. And I worked in a factory for 67 cents a day in a warehouse. And the reason I did that is because I wanted to be alone. I didn't want anybody to bother me. And my high school band director came to that factory. And he said, "Arnold, what are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm making a living." He said, "You're going to college." I said, "I can't go to college. How can I compete with students like you, right out of high school who are playing their instruments?" I hadn't played anything but a machine gun for 3 years. And people who had played in military bands for 3 or 4 years. I can't compete with them. He said, "You're going to college." He insisted. So he went to Ithaca College, which is his alma mater, paid my matriculation fee, waived my audition, literally pushed me into college. And he also went to the band director and the orchestra director and said, "Put this young boy in the first chair." Well, I knew I didn't deserve that. So I said, "Okay, I'll try it for a semester." And I did practice 3 and 4 hours a day so I wouldn't disappoint him or me. I figured out that the only way I was going to get through the war was to keep busy. And to this day, you know my schedule. There is no time for me to think about the war except for times like this. So when I was in college, when I was a sophomore, there was a vacancy for a choir director at a Baptist church, even though I was Catholic, in Cortland, New York. And I went to the pastor and I said, "I would like to apply for the job." He said, "Have you ever conducted choirs?" I said, "Oh, sure." Never had. And the Syracuse Drum and Bugle Corps, they were looking for directors. "Have you ever conducted a drum corps?" "Sure." Never had. I don't know if you know the name Patrick Conway. He was a famous band director along with Sousa and so forth. He was from Homer, New York, by the way, and also conducted a band there. So I went to the mayor. And now I'm still a sophomore in college. I said, "You know, Patrick Conway used to have a band. Where's all that music and instruments and so forth?" "Oh, they're in the basement of City Hall." I said, "What do you think about starting the band again?" He said, "Well, we need a conductor." And I said, "I can do that." He said, "Have you ever conducted a band?" "Oh, yes." Never had. When the Korean War came about, I decided, well, I'm not going to go back to the infantry. And I knew that the Air Force was looking for band directors, so in 1951, I applied for a job as a band director in the Air Force and was accepted. And the same thing happened. I kept extremely busy by always doing more than was expected of me. Not so much that I thought it was necessary for my mission, but it was more for me to keep busy than anything else. And of course, I have many, many stories about my experiences in Germany and the Air Force Band in Washington, D.C.
And you can read so many of those in the book Force of Destiny. But as he prepares to again journey to Normandy for the 75th anniversary of D-Day, there's a good chance those emotions he experienced 3/4 of a century ago will come flooding back, just as they did 5 years ago.
It's always with me. At the beach of Normandy, we did Hymn to the Fallen from Saving Private Ryan. Not only was I bawling, but half the band was bawling too.
What was the audience like?
Well, they came from all over that Normandy area. And the little old ladies that were alive in World War II, not many men were because they were either killed or died since, come up and kiss me on both cheeks with tears in their eyes because I'm still, to them, a liberator.
You are. And if we were all to go there right now, there are a lot of things that we could see. I mean, we could see that same beach that they came ashore. You could even see some of the military equipment that was there at the time. You could see the little church in St. Mary Glees with a paratrooper still hanging from it, just as he was that day when John Steele got hung up on the steeple. There are a lot of things that we could see that remind us of it, but we weren't there, and you were. And here on a day, the 70th anniversary, when the President of the United States and all these other world leaders are there, you're there conducting a band, not just as something that's interesting to you, but something that you lived and something that killed your friends. What did that feel like to be in that spot at that moment doing what you were doing?
Well, the President of France was also there, along with the President Obama. And on YouTube, you can see the President giving the speech at the military cemetery where 9,600 people who died at Normandy are buried. And I'm sitting directly behind the President when he finishes his speech. He turned around and shook hands with, there were only about, I think, 20 or 30 veterans of D-Day who were there. And both presidents shook hands with me, and that's on YouTube. That, again, very, very moving.
I know you don't stare when you look back. You made that clear to us, and I'm going to remember that. That's a powerful statement. But do you ever look back and say, why me? How did this all work out the way it did for me? Why am I the one that survived all of this, that has had all these opportunities, and here I am all these years later still going and having the privilege of honoring all those guys who aren't still here?
Well, yeah, there's almost a feeling of guilt. But on the other hand, I feel like I have to continue to give, that my life was spared, and as long as I can continue to give, I'm going to. And I have three contracts to conduct when I'm 100 years old, and I'm going to do it, by the way.
No one who's ever had the privilege of meeting Colonel Gabriel would ever question that guarantee. So keep an eye out for him on June 6th. And to access the complete original interview with him or the other D-Day survivors you heard from today, visit hometownheroesradio.com. Again, you can also find the full speech from President Reagan on D-Day's 40th anniversary there. And I think the final words of his address that day would be a fitting way to wrap things up today.
Here in this place, where the West held together, let us make a vow to our dead. Let us show them by our actions that we understand what they died for. Let our actions say to them the words for which Matthew Ridgway listened, I will not fail thee nor forsake thee. Strengthened by their courage, heartened by their value, and borne by their memory, let us continue to stand for the ideals for which they lived and died. Thank you very much, and God bless you all.
Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.